I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Our guest today is Patrick LeBrun. Patrick, welcome back.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, Patrick is our guy who covers the French scene, and there's a lot going on in France right now with the Front National, with Macron, with labor policy and labor laws and labor upheavals, deindustrialization, and so forth. So we're just going to do a quick tour of what's happening in France. So where do you want to begin?
Well, I guess we could start with some of the first moves he made after becoming president. And that was, he's adjusting well to being a political animal from being a technocrat. And that is that he helps those who helped him and he hurts those who didn't support him. And one of the ways in which the French electorate is divided between those who voted nationalists and those who voted for Macron is the peripheral France, they call it. That is, those who live furthest away from the big cities that are the economic engines of the country are the ones who voted for the Front National in the largest numbers. So it's rural areas, it's suburban areas, and it's formerly industrial areas that have been left behind by the process of globalization. Really, the easiest way to, I guess, translate this divide is, you know, those who are content with globalization, those who have benefited from it, whether they are upper middle class, urban people, whether they are immigrants, and those who do not benefit from globalization. And he made a major change that deprived a lot of these rural areas where the way that they run their budgets is a lot of small towns will actually combine together into large communes, they call it, and they pool their budget. They get a certain cut from the national government because they don't tax as much directly. And they don't have the same, it's much more centralized than it is in America. You don't have a system where, like in America, people are taxed based on their real estate holdings, based on their housing, you know, by the municipality and that money going to the school, right? Everything is, for the most part, centralized in France, and then money is sent back out from the central government. And so he's cut off these rural areas. And that's it's interesting also because it deprives a lot of people from the establishment parties who want to hold on to their traditional, let's say, organizational advantage that they have over him. He has a lot of very powerful backers, especially from the more economically centrist internationalists, I think is the phrase that the Washington Post is using for Jewish financial interests, has a lot of these kinds of backers. But in terms of the rank and file of the Socialist Party, they have not followed him into his new party. The forward is essentially how you would, forward is how you would translate it. He also has a major parliamentary majority, and I actually know someone who is a member of parliament in his party. And basically what happened is, you know, young people who were parliamentary assistants, who were waiting for, you know, the person who controlled their seat to die, you know, who had been sitting in the seat forever, they thought, well, here's my chance to jump ahead in line. And so at the age of, you know, 30-something, after spending 10 years working in the field, they decided to just attach his party name to next to their name. And that was enough to get them to win, even if they had very, very little name recognition. It was just a brand that was very hot for that time of the year. But it's a brand that's really quickly dropping in cachet.
Well, it doesn't really stand for anything. When you get right down to it, right? It's just a vehicle for getting the stealth socialist candidate elected president.
Yes, exactly. It really is. It was, and I really wonder how far ahead they thought, if he really thought, well, after I become president, then I'll have my own party and dominate parliament. But he's doing exactly that. He's, you know, doesn't need a single vote from the traditional center-right party or from the socialist party in order to pass any legislation. And so when he proposes something, even if we see protests in the street, as we're seeing now, it's very likely that he'll get his way.
How is this playing out in terms of industrial policy and labor relations?
So that's the big change now. He began the summer, I guess, raising a little bit of interest on the nationalist side because he had nationalized a shipbuilding company, and that was seen, totally unexpected. However, it seems like it might be just a holding pattern before they sell it to an Italian company. But it made a lot of people think, okay, is he actually going to go his own way on things, or is he not the tool of these financial interests as we had expected? Now we're seeing the new reform of the labor laws being proposed, and that is going to be a big change. It's one of the people in the far left party called it a social coup d'état, meaning that basically everything that has been taken for granted in terms of the protection of industrial jobs for decades and decades is going to be taken out in one fell swoop. The march, they've had two major mobilizations in the streets so far, and the first one was kind of a disappointment. It was under 100,000. The second one was quite a few more. And in fact, they're calling themselves the slackers now, because when Macron was talking to a group of French expats in Greece, he gave a speech that was filmed, and he said that basically the only people who will try to stop him are, I think he said it was slackers and hardliners, and I can't remember the other, extremists and something else, I forget. And so now they're holding up signs calling themselves slackers against Macron or slackers against reform. It's going to be a major change. So one of the things that are a way of protecting industrial jobs in France is that a company, especially a foreign company that has a factory in France, when they set it up, often they're given breaks, tax breaks and tax incentives and so on. And so one way to make sure that they're not just going to leave before they pay anything back in the system is that they can't leave that factory until that factory is proven to not turn a profit. Now, that's something that's very concrete. You can show how much they spend, how much they earn, what do they produce, what's it worth in the market, and know exactly how profitable a factory is. Now it's going to be adjusted ever so slightly, as they would say. And that is, it's going to be if the company can make more of a profit from another factory somewhere else, then they can shut down the factory. And that's one big difference here, is that this is something that is no longer a fact that's happened. We're talking about the projections of the company's economists. And two, you can always find, especially compared to any European country, a cheaper place to make goods. And if you can just credibly imagine that those goods can be made of the same quality at this other factory, then you can make this claim to the French economy minister or whichever government organization would be in charge of handling this, and shut things down and fire people by the thousands. And the thing is, in these factory towns, it could be 20% of the workforce in a single factory. And so it would be really the destruction of the entire political economy of a town. You don't have to look very much farther than what Trump described as the American carnage in his inauguration speech in the Rust Belt. And what happens, not just in terms of money in the pocket, but in terms of drug abuse and crime and the destruction of families when you have this kind of sudden shock of mass unemployment.
Well, this is really terrifying.
Yeah.
Is the left screaming bloody murder?
They are. And, one thing I'd love to see more of is the nationalists to say, see, I told you so.
Yeah.
Because
definitely.
One of the things that the left is saying is that, we didn't really vote for Macron to do this because we were really just trying to stop fascism, And I've seen them say exactly that on French television, people from the Mélenchon camp saying this sort of thing.
Right.
And it's like, guess what, buddy? You can't have it both ways,
Have you seen, there's a new tweet out from Marine Le Pen, the oligarchies of our countries are working to the enslavement of man and the depletion of the planet.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty good. You know, it's apropos of the present moment. Yeah, but you have to stop somebody like this from getting into power.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Congratulations, lefties.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, I mean, now the interesting thing is that, you know, we can divide the left from the workers, because when it comes to the working class, when it comes to people who are categorized as ouvrier, right, like, you know, like working in factories or working blue-collar jobs, that's the one group and only group that Marine Le Pen really dominated. I mean, there was more than 60% of them voted for her. And so, you know, that's pretty impressive. There's this phrase used for, you know, why she lost that's kind of poetic. They said it was a Bobo, Barbu, and Breton. You know, it's like Bobos are the bourgeois bohemians, the people in the cities who are, you know, upper middle class and benefit from globalization and are only interested in the cultural issues of the left, not in the economic justice issues of the left. And the Barbu, the bearded, would be the Muslims. And then the Bretons would be just the fact that, you know, Bretons, not feeling very French, just have this history of, especially, you know, not feeling nationalist, have a history of supporting, you know, the center left as a result. And this time they came out really, really big for Macron because they're not French nationalist. They feel Breton first, a great many of them. And so these were the three groups that, that really, if you took them away, it would have been a much closer result, if not Marine Le Pen winning the results. Also, one thing just to point out as a quick aside, because I know that there's this sense on the alt-right that women are somehow not nationalist, that they're somehow like a problem in their DNA. When you have a double X chromosome, you can't be a nationalist. You know, she got this time slightly more support from women, and historically, the nationalist right does much better with women in France. And the whole reason why women didn't get the vote until 1945 was that the, you know, the left-leaning Third Republic was afraid that as soon as women got the vote, it would be the end of the left in France.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that. They thought, oh, women would just listen to the priests and vote for conservative things.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it really is a moment to say, see, I told you so, to the far left, because, you know, there's really no excuse for them to, you know, if they have if they're actually truly have the values of the left, there's no excuse, there's no reason for them to have voted for Emmanuel Macron, because he had, even before he was president, even before he was a candidate, he was always seen as a tool of the oligarchs and always seen as a guy who was very eager to break apart the crown jewels of French industry and to sell them off to the highest bidder.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. One thing that strikes me as problematic, and this is specifically in the context of the Catalonian referendum, is the Front National holding fast to sort of state-defined nationalism in France,
mm-hmm.
Rather than being truly ethnically nationalist. I think that they probably would do better if they would go to the Bretons and say, we support your national self-consciousness and autonomy and self-determination. And in fact, if you want to leave France, we're not going to harass you. If you make such a decision, that might actually be a good thing. Unfortunately, a lot of times these sort of resentful subject populations, they're not really motivated rationally to take political positions. Their political positions are essentially half thought out neurotic attitudes towards the dominant people. I mean, this is very true with the Celtic minorities in Great Britain, for instance.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. I mean, you know, I've really enjoyed recently listening to Mark Collett. I never met the guy, but he's been doing more and more podcasts, as far as just at least ones that I've been aware of. And you can tell this is a guy who's done a lot of work on the ground and, you know, in actual retail politics. And he was a BNP guy. And he, yeah, I mean, like, how does the BNP do in Scotland? Yeah, I mean, you probably count up on a on your hands how many vote for them.
Yeah,
right?
Very poorly. Very poorly, yeah. Because of an unthinking attachment to great state nationalism, or whatever you want to call it. And you're seeing that same kind of thing from rightist people commenting on Catalonia today. I don't want to break up the Spanish state. It's like, well, why do we reflexively identify with the state rather than with the nation? Aren't we nationalists?
Yes. Well, I'd say, you know, not only are we nationalists, but also identitarianism is specifically addressing this issue. You know, as soon as you have these groups break up, you know, there's an immediate rebalancing, because, you know, these subject populations who have a different national identity, for some reason, systematically, they team up with the grand coalition of the left. You know, just as you have people who are religiously conservative, for some reason, whether it's in Italy or India, they team up with, you know, neoliberal capitalists. You know, who knows why? But they seem to always end up in the same camp on the right. And these people who feel, even if they're not, you know, out and out separatists who want a separate republic, if they just want devolution of powers, they still find themselves in the camp of the grand left coalition. Even though when you go on a issue by issue, I mean, especially in Brittany, I can speak to in, you know, the northwest portion of France that kind of juts out into a point into the Atlantic. I mean, if you go issue by issue with people, they're not, you wouldn't expect them to vote as solidly left as they do. And I would imagine, you know, I don't know Scotland, but I'd have to imagine it'd be the same way.
I think it would be the same way, honestly.
Yeah. 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 Catalonia, as well. I mean, you know, the reason there, I mean, and this is unfortunate that this is often is, the driving factor is economic concerns and not, romantic nationalism or something like this. But yeah, once again there, I mean, they are leaving because they're the economic engine of the country and they feel taken advantage of, frankly, and they feel held back. And of course, there's going to be a rebalancing as soon as they take apart these two countries. And actually, the day that we're speaking here, for those who are listening, is the day that the referendum was held in 2017, and the Guardia Civil came from other parts of Spain, wielding batons and breaking into voting sites and basically putting hundreds of people in the hospital for having the temerity to vote on whether or not they should be independent.
Yeah, it's an amazing sight, and it strikes me as a measure of the immaturity and muddle-headedness and vapidness of the people on the so-called identitarian and ethno-nationalist right that they're so confused about this issue.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, too. I think that anyone who speaks Spanish, too, should really get how different these people are. I mean, you can go from Argentina to Mexico to Madrid and understand what people are saying. You know, I don't speak Spanish very well, but I can do that. I can't go to Catalonia and understand what the hell they're saying. If I'm reading it, I have to really think it through. It's like, you know, a kind of mix of, oh, here, this sounds like this thing in French. It sounds like this thing in Spanish. It's so different that, yeah, I mean, it's really incredible to think that thousands and thousands of miles separate the people of Buenos Aires and Madrid or Mexico City and Madrid, but they can speak to each other in their own mother tongues and understand each other. But, you know, going to Barcelona, I'm sure in Barcelona people would be bilingual, but let's say the mountains nearby, you know, it's different. It's a big difference. And I remember once, long ago when I was in a master's program, a university program, they had this thing where people would promote their own country's cultures, and the Spanish were doing it there for themselves. And I remember, like, some of the people from Barcelona kind of, like, almost like they felt obliged to kind of pull me aside and tell me, like, yeah, you know, it kind of feels funny to me to be talking about Spanish stuff because I really don't feel Spanish. It's like, you know, what are you talking about? You're like, you spent the last 20-something years of your life in Spain, right? They don't know the Spanish national anthem. They don't feel any attachment to the, you know, the flamenco dance or the any of the traditions of the other parts of Spain. They are and only are Catalonian. And that was numerous people told me this in separate conversations, and it was, you know, everyone that I knew closely with that was this case. I guess I just have a, you know, on top of that, kind of a knee-jerk sympathy for people who want to have their own separatist nationalist groups. And I think overall, in terms of the making the case of a Europe for Europeans will be a lot easier if these issues of smaller peoples being forced to live amongst others and having less political power than they think they deserve are done away with through new organizations, new ways of dividing power.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting. Spain's national anthem doesn't have words because...
Oh, really?
Yeah, because of the conflicts between the different linguistic and cultural groups in Spain.
No kidding. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, so they have this compromise where they don't have any words.
That's hilarious. I mean, that kind of tells you, like, how untenable this is, right? It's like in a microcosm what the problem is. I saw once a kind of a comedy program from Spain where they stop people on the streets and they ask them the national anthem. And the only people who had a response were the people who were over 60 years old. And they all sang Cara al Sol, which is the Frankist song,
right?
The song of the Falange. They didn't know that that was not the national anthem for quite some time.
Well, I was told this. There was a guy who sent this in today. I haven't checked it out. I assume he knows what he's talking about. He is Spanish, but
apparently
they don't have words. Well, this is what diversity does. When you have to get a bunch of people on the same page about certain things, you just can't do certain kinds of things anymore. So I thought that was quite telling and interesting. Yeah, I do think that letting letting Britain go, if necessary, or at least signaling, it doesn't cost you anything to signal.
Yeah.
Right. And to be sincere about it, to say, look, we're nationalists and we realize that you have your own regional consciousness. It's not a regional consciousness. It's a national consciousness. They might be a region of France, but they're a nation without a state. And if you simply say, look, we sympathize with that. That's what we're all about. And if you feel the necessity of breaking away and forming your own country, we will not stand in your way. We will help you. We will do everything. We would never have this kind of spectacle that they're having in Catalonia if the Front National were in charge of France. That would be something, a message to get out there. And the same with the people in the south of France, and the same with the people, the Basques.
Yeah.
Just say, look, we recognize, or the people in Savoy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not such a bad thing to do.
Yeah, Marine Le Pen, actually, their roots of the family are in Brittany. And she has had very nasty things to say to people who talk about, Breton identity. And it's unfortunate. They really have a kind of very old 19th century sense of what nationalism means. And it is to the point now where that will be something that could hold them back from winning.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a very pragmatic person, and I'm really, really want to see her put forward the referenda to freeze immigration, to start remigration, these various things that will help defend Europe and our people from being replaced. And so, being pragmatic, in her case it would be, or being, you know, in my case it would be, you know, an honest, heartfelt position to say, we respect what you think of yourselves, and we will not, you know, we will be a neutral broker in this process, right? And not, you know, stand in your way. And I think that in in Britain, I would have to imagine that after the referendum and after the loss of the Scottish nationalist vote, that it must have been a diffusing of tensions as well after that took place, even though it was a loss, just to have gone through an open and transparent and democratic process is food for the soul for people, right?
Right, exactly. It makes you feel respected. And while the vast majority of Catalonians want a referendum, they're pretty evenly split on whether or not they want to leave Spain.
Yeah.
So it just strikes me as the smart thing to do, even for the Spanish central government, to say, okay, we will accede to what the vast majority want and give them their referendum, and then hope that, you know, if you really want to keep Spain together, you've got a 50-50 chance of doing that. And you've actually got a greater chance of doing that if you don't get in the way of the referendum.
Indeed.
You know, so they're not playing it well. They're acting... They're acting hysterical, and it's not the right way to go about this stuff. Let's talk about the changes in the National Front. There have been some shakeups there. What can you say about that?
So, the departure of François Philippot happened about 10 days ago before this recording. And that had been something that was talked about immediately after the loss in the second round of the presidential elections. And he is, so during that process of the elections as well, just kind of go back in time, there was the dropping of the issue of getting rid of the euro. And now the thing about, I'm sorry, I said François Philippot, I meant Florian Philippot. The thing about his approach in the party, and he's very young. He's only, I think he was 35 when he became a very close advisor, maybe even before that. He's got to be, 36 or 37 now. The thing about his approach is he went to one of the top schools in France that most of the presidents had gone to. ENA was the school he went to. And he has this very technocratic view of how to govern. He's very focused on the issues of national sovereignty, of monetary sovereignty, of getting rid of the euro and leaving the European Union. And he really studiously avoids the ethnic questions that are really at the center of people's minds. And I think you made the joke a couple of years ago when we were talking, and it's so true about right wingers preferring to talk about monetary policy, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, rather than the tough issues of race, and so that's where his impact has been. Now, the positive thing that he did was he was very focused on developing this kind of working class outreach, and it worked. Like I said, it's the only group they dominated with. They got over 60%. So the question is going forward for the Front National is, did they lose a potential majority by focusing too much on this segment? That's one question. And not having a broader appeal. Another is, well, maybe they couldn't. Maybe even if your conclusion is, well, no, they really couldn't have broadened the appeal. If they did try to broaden it, they would have failed to make this intense victory, this intense gain within this one segment of the population. Okay, maybe that's the case. Now, if you take that together with the fact that the Socialist Party is probably, it's hard to predict the future, but the Socialist Party is an entire, completely divided and weakened entity. So the likelihood that they will be able to rally these people in 4 or 5 years is very, very low. What is the likelihood that the people around the far left candidate, Mélenchon, will be able to win them back? Very unlikely. Mélenchon is basically everyone around him is kind of, a millennial, urban, and quite, often fairly effeminate. And so not really, and also often not European. And so not going to have much of the appeal to this same crowd. And of course, Macron as well, with his, you know, globalization policies, really not likely to win this group back. So can they hold on to this big majority that they have with the working class and then develop a platform going forward that would expand this coalition that they've built so far? And I think that's possible. I do think that's possible. I think that the fact that they're going to have this "I told you so" moment now with those who didn't vote for them, and to point out, you know, just the utter inability of the left to defend the interests of working people, which, you know, to you and I has been obvious for quite some time, but you know, now we have really concrete, undeniable, final proof, and
it's not that they're unable. They're not even trying.
They're not even trying. Yeah,
yeah. That's the thing, and we have to look at Macron in the same way that we look at Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
These people are globalist sociopaths who are totally duplicitous and totally without conscience and are there simply to swindle people, working people, out of their votes in order to gain the power to basically dismantle first world industrial economies and replace them with some kind of globalist plantation economy. That's the end game. That's what they're trying to do, and that's what they're achieving to do. They're not failing at all in what they're doing. They're very successfully screwing people and very successfully swindling people. That's the plan, unfortunately.
Yeah, there was an excellent short video that was, I don't know if it was filmed by them, but it was promoted by the Alain Sorrel people. And it was an interview or, you know, kind of a monologue from an Italian psychiatrist talking about Macron and focusing on his youth, focusing on his you know, affair with his married teacher who was over 25 years older than him, and the fact that this woman later married him. Going through his life and his friendships and his way of being. And it really is very much, you know, if not a sociopath, and definitely really far on the narcissistic scale. And also, you know, in many ways sheltered. And, you know, with narcissists, they don't think about other people's experiences. And now he's in charge of the well-being of over 60 million people, of whom there are many, many different kinds of experiences, many different kinds of needs and that they have from society. And he's entirely focused on his own needs and his own interests and can't see beyond that of himself and his social class. And he's constantly getting pats on the back from very powerful, wealthy, influential people. And he's doing exactly what they want. Yeah, exactly as you described it.
Yeah, he's an interesting case, a sort of Justin Trudeau, Tony Blair kind of case, too.
Yeah, yeah. Now, inside the FN, and, you know, so this is the thing, is that, you know, Florian Philippot has left the party. He's talking a lot about the inner workings of the party, but of course from his own point of view. But there's not a lot coming from the other camp. They've kind of closed ranks, and they're just giving, you know, kind of press release pablum. Now, if what Florian Philippot says is true, I think that nationalists like us should be very pleased with what he's saying. And that is that he's saying, you know, someone said to him before, in an interview, for example, they said, all right, this is not the first time that there's been a split in the FN. There was that split between Jean-Marie Le Pen and Bruno Maigret. And that was when a lot of the apparatchiks who were the most effective left the party because they were upset with some administrative decisions that Jean-Marie Le Pen made, his failure to support lower-level candidates and try to make basically all about him and his national aspirations. And the people who had left were really the hardcore ideologically as well in terms of the nationalist side of things. You know, some would even describe themselves as, you know, revolutionary nationalist, which is kind of the French way of saying fascism. Others would be like Pierre Vial, who were ethno-nationalists, right? And very clear about there being ethno-nationalists and not state nationalists. And so what he, when he was sold this, like, oh, well, Bruno Magret left and he failed and all this, it triggered something in him because he said, well, look, all the people who are around Bruno Magret, except for him, they're all back in the FN and they're all in the driver's seat right now. And that scares me. And, well, that means that they're going in a much more ethnically conscious, racially conscious direction. I certainly hope that's correct, that he's not just saying this to, you know, throw stones at them, or that this is kind of a conspiracy in his mind against him and that he's kind of being, you know, the scapegoat for the failure in the last election unfairly. I hope he's telling the truth on that. Now, the other thing, he is also launching his own party. My sense is, though, that he's not going to have a lot of luck doing that because there already are people who are kind of taking his line of being focused on sovereignty. And that would be Nicolas Dupont-Aignan, who was in the second tour. He had thrown his support to Marine Le Pen. He is the inheritor of Philippe de Villiers, of this kind of, not, you know, not the exact party structure, but basically the same thing. This kind of, you know, socially conservative to the right of the center-right party and more sovereignty-focused than them, but not nationalist like the FN. They get about 5% of the vote. The guy who's in charge of that segment of the voting populace has been in that place for over 7 years, I think, as a face of the movement. And his experience in politics is over 20 years. And he's got, he's welcomed into that by Philippe de Villiers. The thing about Florian Philippot, is that he doesn't have a godfather anymore. The only reason he was ever on TV is because Marine Le Pen sent him there in her place to be on TV. He's not as charismatic as these others. And also, you know, he doesn't have, and, you know, this crowd, this segment is much more socially conservative. And so, he's not going to win these people over either. So that's, I think he's got a very short, you know, if it was the case that I thought, okay, they did the analysis of the country and they said, okay, there's this group of people who have, you know, really high positives when it comes to Florian Philippot, but they would never vote for Marine Le Pen. So go out there and create your own party and win this group and then endorse her in the second tour. You know, if that was the case, I'd be all for it, right? Some kind of clever strategy. I just don't believe that's the case at all. I think this is a clash of personalities that the too many people are sick and tired of this kind of like, oh, let's just talk about the euro approach when Europe is being invaded and when this is a losing issue, especially amongst the older voters who they did very poorly with.
Exactly, exactly. It makes no sense to focus on things, well, monetary policy, yeah.
Here we go again, yeah.
Here we go
again. Talk about the gold standard.
Let's talk about the gold standard. That'll... Yes, yes. Well, be sure to leave a gold standard for the caliphate. It's absurd.
And that would be very halal, actually. They have to have a gold standard. So,
yeah. Right.
Why not? It would make things easier for them. That'd be, yeah. No, this is the time where the clock is ticking on nationalist political movements at the polling booths, and you know, I've said for a while I thought this was the last chance to win at the ballot box. And, you know, maybe it was. Maybe it was. Maybe the only chance going forward is a caretaker government run by the military on the values of ethno-nationalism. That's And the door is closed on doing this through democratic processes. Maybe, maybe not. You know, I guess, you know, we'll see. But we should be open-minded for either one.
Well, yeah, it's plan A and plan B.
Yeah,
The goal is always the same, but we are willing to come up with plan A or plan B. We can do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way.
Yeah. Yeah, and the people who are, you know, who are kind of sounding the hysterical alarm about nationalist politicians, I mean, they will have to share the blame for whatever difficulty and pain comes through the process later on, if it has to be that route. Because, I mean, I don't think you're going to find many people who would have said, like, oh, well, I'm glad we put it on, you know, of the nationalist camp. Who's, yeah, of course, this is the only way to do it. Everyone is going to be, who's in the camp of supporting a caretaker government will be disappointed Democrats, in a sense, small D Democrats, you know. There will be people who have given up on the democratic process, but have tried it. And, yeah, I mean, when those really dark days come, and for a lot of Europe, those dark days are already here. I mean, you hear the Europa report every week on fascination, and it's just, my God, like, you know, something has to be done. And the patience for democratic process is thinning, and the likelihood of success is disappearing with every passing year.
Yeah, at a certain point, we're just going to have to dispense with these little games, basically.
Yeah. I'm entirely confident that, you know, the European people, whether they find themselves in Europe or Australia or North America, will deal with this. It's just a question of how.
Yeah, exactly.
And when, and that's it. So, but yeah, that reminds me, there was a... you know, I didn't prepare this part for our discussion today, but there was a big fight just after Donald Trump went to visit France between the chief of staff of the army and President Macron. Now, there were major, I mean, tens of billions of dollars cut from the military budget. And that was, on the surface, what the fight was about. Now, if there was anything else behind the scenes in terms of whether it was the policy change on Syria and, you know, the slow shift to accepting the fact that Assad is the president of Syria and will remain the president of Syria, was that part of the reason why he quit? I can't say. But yeah, there was a very unusual public fight between the chief of staff of the army and President Macron. And when I saw that in the news, when I started hearing these top military brass speaking very publicly against their elected leader, I kind of got a little tinge of hope that the day of a caretaker government was coming sooner rather than later. But yeah, I'm not sure it was around issues that we actually care about.
That is very interesting.
But I have to say, though, that morale is even lower now. You know, when I talk to those who I know in the French military, even lower now than it was under Hollande. And frankly, I think that a lot of people are, if they had the means to organize and to communicate with each other, that they would do it. I'll just leave it at that, I guess.
yeah, again, it's just really plan A or plan B.
Yeah, yeah.
We all choose one or the other, whether we know it or not, with every election that we participate in, with every time we remain silent or speak out about things, we're choosing plan A or plan B.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if I might return a bit to the earlier discussion about, you know, the acceptability of subnationalism.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy who I interviewed for Countercurrents, and, you know, the interview with him is published there, from Young Brittany, or Jeune Bretagne. And it was, they actually had a big schism with the rest of the identitarian movement, because one of the things that they did was organize a conference in which they wrote a kind of constitution in waiting for the Republic of Brittany.
Mm-hmm.
And also they regularly would put forward candidates on a totally separate ticket that was about Breton nationalism. and not part of the FN. Now, the thing is, if they did put people forward in the FN, one, it would not really be in keeping with identitarian principles, and two, it would get even less support than their very marginal, right-wing nationalist Breton party would get. But unfortunately, that was enough to create a schism between the identitarians in the rest of the country, and in particular their headquarters in Nice, and the identitarians of Brittany. The guy is now in charge of the one of the top news sites for what is called by the establishment fake news, of course, and that's Brezh Info, which is BREIZH.info. I think that's how they go. I should make sure that's the case before I tell you. But and that's Brezh is the the Breton name for Brittany. And that's not it. Is that one? Oh wow, it's a really nasty picture up today. Someone's messed up hand. I think it was like 20 million people read their news on a monthly basis. So they have an incredible reach with their news stories. And it's kind of a it's not really like Drudge Report where they post just headlines. That would be fdesouche.com. It's kind of a French Drudge Report on the nationalist side. But they're a source for a lot of news that would be blackballed by the national press because it's about the violence of immigrants or about terrorism or what have you. But I think they're probably the second largest site that was marked for destruction and blockage by the mainstream press in France. So. I'm kind of rehashing what we said earlier, but nationalist parties in these countries that contain subnational identities have to move beyond this kind of, like Charles Maurras' view of what nationalism is and kind of broaden the tent a little bit. And I hope that will be part of the shakeup at the FN. It's too early to tell now, and it would require a change in the attitude of Marine Le Pen herself. So I'm not going to be holding my breath, but it is something that I think that there are a lot of others who realize the need for that as well. And so, if there's enough of a groundswell of support, and she feels it's necessary to win and necessary also to keep the internal battles within her own party from spilling over, then maybe she will make that change. One of the other personnel changes that happened was right after the legislative elections, her niece quit as well. And she is going to do business with her father, who's involved in import-export in West Africa. And it's probably a couple of things. One is she's just kind of sick of being this, hated pariah in the National Assembly. It's really they're there with the impossibility of ever writing laws, because when she was there, it was only three people. Now it's only, I think, eight people there from the Front National. And also because she really represented a kind of very socially conservative, almost royalist brand of nationalism that was very popular in the west side of Paris and in Versailles. And whenever they would have events there or protests, she would often go there, but not very popular outside of that, and really not future of the party either. I mean, she's, we always say this, point this out, she's a gorgeous woman and an excellent speaker, very composed, especially considering her youth. A mother, a volunteer in the French National Army, but also very strong in her convictions, and her convictions are not popular ones. So it's hard to see a way forward for the FN in any route to power other than the presidential election. We've got 4.5 years to the next presidential election, And structurally, the challenges that were there now kept her down to really an only one-third vote, higher than they've ever gotten, but almost twice as much as her father did. But, you know, is that ever going to be enough? Is there any way they can make up that ground they need to win the country in 4.5 years? It's really going to be tough.
Well, Patrick, we've been going at this for about an hour, so we should probably wrap up. Are there any other things you'd like to say just to transition to the end of this conversation?
Well, I guess I'll say that the people of Catalonia are in my heart and on my mind, and I wish them all the best. And whether you're a nationalist of the left or the right, you know, you certainly have my sympathy. And you know, I'd say one thing, too, that there are, especially civic nationalists, I find, who are the free market kind, like Geert Wilders or like UKIP. There are civic nationalists of the socialist kind, like Alex Salmond in Scotland. But I think that for ethno-nationalists, you have to have, I don't think that there are any exceptions to this, you eventually have to come around to supporting some kind of protection for the workers of your country as they face down much more powerful and organized people who control capital. And you have to support some kind of social safety net for your own people. Otherwise, I really don't know how you can call yourself an ethno-nationalist.
And, right.
So I think that, you know, with those thoughts, that might be a healthier way to assess these nationalist efforts around Europe, around the European world, and also to think about what will put us in a better position to stand united as a united front against the parasitical people that have taken the reins of power in our countries, and against those invaders who are raping women by the hundreds every single day.
Right, right, exactly. Nationalism is not going to win if it's just something that's confined to a right-wing ghetto. Nationalist movements have always transcended the distinctions of the political spectrum, and our goal as ethno-nationalists is to see nationalism as the new common sense of a society, and we can't therefore be upset when people with the quote-unquote wrong politics suddenly show up think that nationalism is a solution to the problems that they face.
Yeah, there was a really, I don't know if this is going to take us off track, but I heard a ridiculous statement by someone on a podcast recently who's an alt-rightist. There was, a Latina female at a college in California who stole someone's MAGA hat. Mm-hmm. And she was screaming and yelling at him. And this guy thought that this was somehow related to the fact that there is a social safety net, that there's welfare in the United States. And I thought to myself, it's like, all right, so he's saying that when a Latina female gets hysterical and then gets physical with a man, that this could only happen in a country with a social safety net? You know,
right?
Or that it wouldn't have happened in that same country before the social safety net existed. I mean, if he wants to convince people that he's a virgin, I think he's done it. But if he wants to make any kind of social or economic commentary, that's best kept for the AM radio cuckservatives.
Right.
But you know, that's, I mean, the word hysterical itself is, it comes from the uterus. You know,
right.
It's actually meant to describe you know, women getting and really angry and then fighting. I think though that, you know, I feel like with Charlottesville, there is a growing up process that started for a lot of the new arrivals, and especially for new arrivals from the Manosphere. You know, I think that they realize that when you're doing revolutionary politics, even if you support the cops against Black Lives Matter, the cops are still not your friends.
Right.
And there's not going to be any, that, you know, that your positive feelings toward law and order and those who are supposed to bring it will not be reciprocated with justice and kindness if you're part of a revolutionary movement.
Yeah,
no matter exactly what kind of revolutionary movement it is.
Exactly.
And yeah, and also, I mean, look, you know, these people from Mexico and elsewhere have carved out a de facto position in the American political economy. And they did it with the complicity of the elites, but also with a lot of hard work on their part. And they don't have a de jure place in this political economy. And so what we're saying now to them is that, guess what? You know, your place is not going to be here in a few months because we've taken over. Of course they're going to fight back, you know? I mean, there's no way we can say to them, listen to reason or look at this objectively. You know, they are going to fight and we will have to fight. And whether that's physical or whether it's metaphorical, it'll probably have to be both in order to win this. And on the other hand, in terms of Charlottesville, I mean, you know, for the first time, people like those who were in that crowd, after many, many years, have a culture in America that is not a European hegemony, right? And all it's already been erased in terms of every corporate leadership position, in terms of every government position, with the only exception being that of the president. And, you know, even the most positive congressman towards our position will walk back a statement as soon as it's made, if it's made toward any, you know, says anything about European cultural hegemony. And so, and we're saying, no, we're going to take back cultural hegemony of this country. So, of course, people are going to fight back. And, of course, they're going to have the, you know, everything that every group and every power that they've already brought into their camp that benefits from not having European cultural hegemony will be fighting against us. And really, you know, when we're talking about these statues, it's just the fact that these are the last vestiges of European cultural hegemony in America. So getting that back, especially when America is only two-thirds European, is going to be a very tough and, frankly, violent process. So, you know, I think that Charlottesville, I hope that the momentum stays alive. I hope that there are more actions. I hope it expands beyond the South. But, yeah, this is not going to be an easy process. And it's going to be, you know, a very serious revolutionary process.
I agree completely. Well, Patrick, we will continue this conversation soon. And okay, thank you so much. There's so much happening in Europe today, whether in Spain or Catalonia or France or Germany. So we'll definitely be back in touch very soon.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.